City of Education Committee, we're going to move ahead with hearings on the bills we have before us today. Other members of my committee, I expect to show up when they are through with their other responsibilities. I understand Senator Deckard still has a committee of one going up the road to here. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 456 and invite Senator Morissette to introduce this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to testify up here rather than going out there, but because I am testifying, I will identify myself as Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. I introduced this bill last session having to do with psychotropic drugs and who makes the decision to administer or to recommend who receives the drugs. This is an attempt to clarify the pressure put on parents, perhaps, to either get the drug or I'm not going to deal with your child. I mean, there are some pretty harsh recommendations at times. And so I think this is a very straightforward bill, and we have several people to testify, and so rather than take time away from them, I will simply end my introduction. And Don Stetcher, would you please come up and give your testimony?
Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Don Stetcher, and I am a lobbyist. My title is Associate Director of Government Affairs for Novartis Pharmaceuticals. We are the makers of two different drugs that are used for ADD, ADHD, and some kind of drugs that I guess this bill would attempt to address. I'm also a licensed teacher, 6 through 12, for the last 25 years, and I think I have some insight into the bill. The bill, as it is written, is, from all appearances, prudent, modest, and reasonable. It is always a good idea to have the physician be the ultimate decision maker for what drugs the patient is being put on. And so I stand before you here, or sit before you here, in support of Senate Bill 456, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Okay, as an expert witness, this is the first public hearing. We may have another hearing, and I may ask you some specific questions so before we hear this bill again, but I do appreciate your endorsement of the concept, and that's important. And as a representative of a company that actually makes the product, and probably is in a position to see the use and abuse of the potential abuse of the product, I appreciate the fact that you are saying this is a modest but good attempt to deal with the situation.
It's my pleasure, and I'd be happy to answer questions at a subsequent date.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stetcher. Jim Wittenberg.
Chairman Starr and Senator Morissette, I'm a retired pharmacist, and it may seem like I'm working against myself by testifying for a bill like this, but having been licensed in the state of Oregon for 37 years up until I retired my license in 1999, actually 2000 was finalized, I have witnessed this problem from the beginning, starting as a pharmacist when I was working in Washington State in Yakima, and seeing a young kid named AJ who essentially was put on this drug as a fourth grader, and I saw his personality change just in the period of a month or so, to where that this woman who was his mother said, "I've lost my child. I don't know who he is anymore." The kid has moved from his parents' home into his grandparents' home and eventually left the state. When I came back to Oregon in 1994, one of the first people I talked with was a pastor at the First Presbyterian Church in Portland, Woodley White, who now has his own congregation in Milwaukee with the Milwaukee Presbyterian Church. And he told me about his son and the problems he'd had at the Riverdale School in Portland, along with West Linn High School and at Wilson with the same type of problems of wanting to force his child to be taking these types of drugs. And he eventually moved his child into an alternative school so he could get his education without having to be drugged into submission with these types of compounds. I had never seen a bottle of 1,000 Ritalin before until I moved to Yakima and worked in the pharmacy up there, and I never seen a bottle of these drugs in the quantities that are being used. But in some areas of the state, and I'm not saying it's here, but there are areas of this state where the drug is still being used with regularity, and it's being forced, and the children are being coerced into taking it. I brought a lot of testimony, which we've developed over the last number of years. There's boxes of it which we could bring talking about the problems with this drug. I'm very happy to see Novartis go ahead and endorse this legislation. I'm just looking at children that I've seen as through a pharmacist's eyes who turn from lively, fun little kids into these withdrawn, almost zombie-like children who did what they were told but lost their personality along the way. And it's something that's very scary to me to be watching. And I just applaud you for doing this, and I thank you, Senator Morrison, for bringing this bill to us. If you have any questions along those lines, I should be happy to talk to them. We can talk about this later in a subsequent hearing.
I don't have any questions now, and I've worked with Mr. Wittenberg during the last session to introduce a bill that was a little bit stronger than this, and it had some problems, and so we redrafted it, and I will continue to work with you, Jim.
I appreciate this, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Ed Johnston.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Johnston. I'm from Lincoln County, Toledo, Oregon. I agree with the bill. It's something that's been long overdue. And I can speak also, too, as a former ADA student or kid or whatever you want to say, with the Cal Berkeley and St. Mary's Hospital that did the studies back in the 70s. To best of my knowledge, I was one of the test students or test kids. So, I mean, I know. And I was the one thing that my mom never put me on medication, and I don't believe that when kids are hyperactive and stuff like that, they should be forced on medication, what's going on now. But I would like to add for an amendment dealing where prohibit school personnel recommendations on parents, that if the schools are forcing that, I think there ought to be a penalty to the school's administrators or teachers or anything who's trying to force or put a kid on drugs who really don't need it, because we need to have some savior so the kids are not losing their minds of being forced at a young age on drugs that are mind-altering. So I think that this is a good start, but I think we need to have probably something so if an administrator or something like that is forcing a student or a parent and putting pressure on them, there needs to be some type of criteria where there's a savior for that family. But this is a good start for the bill.
May I?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that, because I think that I agree. We're going to work on the language, and I think we'll have more testimony on that, because we have to be more definite in the recommendation of the teacher to the parent and how that is made. There's got to be some firewall between, you know, the implication: if you don't do this, don't bring your child back. I mean, that the examination by a physician is important to do, and the school people have to be very careful on the way that they make that concern to the parent. So I appreciate
it. All right. And the other thing I'd like to add, too, because I know in past experiences, too, which I was hoping that Senate Bill 529 would get a hearing dealing with school surveys, I know for a fact, especially in Lincoln County Office of School Surveys, they have gone because of kids' answers to put them on medication off of surveys when they didn't need it, because when kids answer surveys, no kid is going to tell the truth on a survey when they're asking that stuff. So, I mean, that's the other frustration. Because we've personally dealt with that, and we've experienced that with my girlfriend's children, and so I could contest to that, and it's really frustrating that they try to do that, putting kids on medications when they don't do that, when they have, they can come up with other ways of putting their attention or their directions and other things, you know, hobbies or other academics, like with astrology and stuff like that, would work a lot better if they find the right direction for a student to put their direction. So their energy is more productive than used in a psychological negative atmosphere.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed.
Let's see. Angie DeLaRoche, Bob Seward, Susan Harris, Yes.
Senator Starr, members of the committee, my name is Angie DeRoche, and I'm here today representing the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. And we're here today actually to support the intent of this bill, but we would like to speak in opposition of how it's actually worded, because we believe the wording in Section 1 doesn't actually facilitates more of the process that has been expressed here as the intent that we're trying to reform. In the scenario where a parent is feeling coerced to put their kids on drugs or they can't keep the kid in school, that process comes after the kid has been diagnosed. And the wording in Section 1, it actually requires the school, when it observes behavioral problems, to send the parent a letter that specifically routes them down a road of becoming diagnosed with some sort of disorder. So, and that is the wording that we would like to see changed, and would like to work with the committee on changing that. We'd like to propose that the letter that gets sent simply describes to the parent the exact behavior observed by the teacher in the classroom, so that the teacher has a way to inform the parent, this is what's happening in the classroom, this is the behavior that's not optimum, this is what is troubling in the classroom, and then stops at that point, and at the same time, Section 2 remains intact, and that the letter cannot recommend that the child be drugged. We would also support, certainly, any addition or amendment to the bill that adds, as the prior testifier suggested, any penalties for the school that forbids a student from coming back into the school unless they are drugged. That's not part of this bill, but if the committee were to go that route, we would support that. I did not have written testimony today, but I did give to you two bills, one that was passed in Utah and one that was passed in Arizona on this subject, for your information and if that's helpful to the committee. Just as a present time, I'll leave you with this last sentence. We advocate for people in these scenarios, for parents in these scenarios, so we have a lot of anecdotal stories, and right now we are working with a parent whose the teacher told her that the son had attention hyperactivity disorder and that the son needed to be evaluated. The parent already had the son in some sort of family counseling environment, and so just worked exclusively with the counselor that they already had. But once the school notified the counselor through the parent that she felt that son had attention hyperactivity disorder, the parent at that moment became excluded from the process. There have been numerous conversations between the counselor and the school counselor, the teacher, and the principal that the parent has not been informed about. The student has a file of evaluation material from both ends that the parent has not been informed about, and she has been called into a meeting tomorrow to face both counselors, the school counselor, a psychiatrist, the school principal, and the teacher. And she has no idea what is about to be said, but they have determined what is wrong with the kid, what the future of that kid is going to be, and they have already informed her that she has limited rights on... They've given her the parental rights sheet on refusing to go into agreement with her son being disabled. There's a month left of the school year. She has already put the kid in tutoring. She's had him take some classes. She's already dealt with the situation from her perspective. They have refused that and have her scheduled for this meeting tomorrow, which we've been lucky enough to send an advocate with her so that she's at least got some defense at that process. So, again, I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm happy to come back. I'm happy to work with the committee on any amendments that we might put together. So.
Appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
No, I appreciate you.
Thank you.
And we did have a chance to talk.
Thanks. Very good. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Seward. I'm with the Oregon Department of Education, Associate Superintendent for the Office of Special Education. And actually, we're here today to support the concept of this bill. We believe that good parent communications, good parent involvement in the education of children is a critical component. We do oppose Section 1 for a technical reason, and the technical reason is this. There are several requirements in the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act that control and require school districts to act in certain ways as they begin to suspect that a child has a disability and to initiate the process for evaluation, communication with parents, development of a plan if the child is found eligible. And we don't have a good clarity right now about the interaction between the language of Section 1 of this bill and those federal requirements about child find and evaluation of children. One of the issues is that once school districts do suspect that a child may have a disability, and by the way, the two terms used here, psychological and behavioral, are phrases that would trigger concern about whether the child's being determined to possibly have a disability or not, that it kicks in a whole set of requirements for school districts to conduct those evaluations, pay for those evaluations, and communicate with parents in very structured ways. So we don't oppose the idea. I think the idea is a very good one. However, I think we need to have some time to really research how Section 1 interacts with and is implicated with IDEA so that we're real clear that the law doesn't put districts at risk. I've invited Susie Harris today with me. She works on our staff as a legal specialist. She knows a great deal more about the legal implications of the IDEA and how it might interact here if you have any further questions.
No, I don't have any further questions right now, but I certainly will talk with you about your concerns, because I do want to improve this bill. We've worked on it for a long time, and I really appreciate your being here and your interest, and I will get in touch.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, I want to restate that I believe the basic idea here of good communications with parents and encouraging them to learn as much as they can about their children is the right idea. We just need to explore what the details are and how they work together.
Good. Thanks.
Sure, appreciate that very much, and we'll be asking that you work together with the sponsor to bring us a bill that we can work on further. We have one other, Wilma Wells, signed up here.
For the record, I'm Wilma Wells with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Chair Starr and members of the committee, Senator Morissette, the intent of the bill is a good one. We could live with some amendments. I feel like, and we would feel like, Section 1 is not exactly one that we would like to see implemented, because having been a teacher and an administrator, and a school sends me home something that says my child has a psychological problem, I'd wonder, or a behavioral problem, where does the teacher get the expertise to tell me that the child has a psychological problem? And I would also bet as an administrator that if I talked with a different teacher, if the child were older and had more than one teacher, I might find out that the problem that appears to one teacher is not a problem to the other, which is why the testimony that preceded me is so important, because if we follow the guidelines that are in IDEA, we won't have this kind of a situation develop so readily. I'd like to work with, be a part of any committee that the senator sees fit to put together to look at modifying this so that it would work. There is, I think, a good reason why school districts probably should not be in a position of making a decision about what medications a child will be taking or must take. I'd be willing to respond to any questions, and I also would appreciate an opportunity to work on the committee.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, and we will be in touch.
Yes. Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
Appreciate the testimony and the willingness to work together on this bill. I think it addresses an important issue, and we will bring it back only when the committee has worked out some reasonable solution. That we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 456 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 844. Senate Bill 844 brought to us by a whole host of sponsors, but primarily at the behest of the WAG teachers of Oregon. And I don't have a witness list here yet, but come right on up and sit down.
Chair Starr and Senator Morissette, John Jeans with the Oregon Vocational Ag Teachers Association. I'm currently a high school teacher at Molalla. We bring before you Senate Bill 844 that states that we'd like to establish the Oregon Future Farmers of America Association. We just celebrated our 75th anniversary last month in Hermiston. And we have been around for a while, so establishing this is interesting at best, but we would like to be recognized by the state, which opens some doors for us to do some different things. The second item, it also identifies the criteria of the Program of Professional Technical Education in Agriculture and Natural Resources, giving direction for the locals. Again, it's nothing new. It is what we have been doing and continue to do so. The piece that... The third item that is of great importance is establishing an Agriculture and Natural Resource Education Advisory Committee to advise the Department of Education, Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and states institutions of higher education on policy matters related to agriculture and natural resources. When we propose this, we know that economically here in the state of Oregon, it's not a time to come asking for money, and that was not our intent. As you get into the bill, it does talk about appropriating money, and that has to do with some existing positions that are in the Department of Education. So it had to be declared in this bill. The Department of Education has added a fiscal statement to this that is quite large, but it's based on a ideal world that where there is lots of money and we can do lots of wonderful things. So it's our hope that as we looked at that, is there something we can amend in this bill to get rid of the fiscal impact that they put on it? And the answer is no, without throwing it away. But the intent of this bill was to work with what we do have, and that doesn't cost anything more. And so I think at some point, whether it be in Ways and Means or somewhere, to take a look at this, it does not ask for any new money, and there isn't any need for new money. With the partnerships that we've developed with business and industry, we believe that these things can be done without any additional funds.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
Is there an agency that would handle this process? Is there an entity that money could be channeled to through the treasurer's office to your agency, and the agency would do it on a funds available basis? I mean, we've done that now for a number of bills, so there is no fiscal impact, but there is an amendment that says, you know, any money, grant money, you are eligible to receive grant money and, you know, federal money, whatever, that money would come through the treasurer's office and go to your agency, and then you would not be required to do anything. You could do it, but you wouldn't be required to until you got the money. Now, if there is, now, if you can handle it all of your, if you can handle it yourself, I would recommend that you draft an amendment that would allow you to do that, that on a funds available basis, and there's, and I'm sure Senator Byers understands this, and there are several versions of that amendment.
The answer is, I'm sure we can do just about anything. The bottom line is, as we put this together and addressed it, it was not to have any fiscal impact. And with the partners that are with us in business and industry, that wasn't the intent. And certainly there is, through that partnership, some way of doing something. But we also did not want to break up. We call ourselves ag education family, where we work closely with the university system, closely with the Department of Ed, and closely with the Ag Teachers Association. And so to try and sidestep any one of the players like the Department of Ed is not our intent. We want to, again, be part of that program, and that is where there is some money now allocated for a position, and we simply want to maintain what we do have and allow these other things to happen within those monies.
I think there's a way of doing it.
Thank you very much. How many programs or chapters of Future Farmers are there now in existence here in the state?
I believe we mentioned 99 last month at Hermiston. We're down just a couple programs from 104 or 5 that we were up to at one point.
Is there a collegiate chapter at OSU?
There's a collegiate chapter at Oregon State, yes.
Thank you. Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Byer, State Senator, District 9. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 844 and urge you to send the bill to Ways and Means where it can get into the funding process. This bill, and I have submitted, hopefully you have it, a letter from Danelle Blair, the agricultural science and technology instructor at Molalla High School. She sent that to my office, so I've been given that to your committee assistant. So hopefully you have gotten that also. Mr. Green just spoke of the specifics of the bill. I am just here to indicate my support for the FFA program and continuing it. I do see I have a copy of the fiscal that I think you have also, and I would agree with the previous testimony that the Department of Education currently has a position for this that has been there for as long as I know. Obviously, Mr. Chair, I believe you were an FFA person when you were in high school. This is not a new program. This is just kind of codifying what they do. And my understanding is the board, the advisory board that they've been created in section 20 of the bill, advisory committee, that is not to be a paid committee. That is strictly volunteers who will volunteer to do that. So I guess the fiscal puzzles me, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. That's why I urge you get the bill to Ways and Means and let them work with that, because, as I said, that should have already been in their budget. It has been for longer than I've been around public education in Oregon. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Well, I guess
Senator Marshall.
Yeah, Senator Byer, I appreciate that information and clarification. So the Department of Education does have some money in the budget to deal with this program.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, there has been an FFA advisor. I don't know what his exact term is, but the current one is has been there for as long as I've been around, and the person they have there now is retiring, but the position has been there, and I have not heard that any proposals to eliminate position.
Okay, I guess my question relates to additional cost to implement this program, and maybe there isn't an additional cost, I don't know, but and as I mentioned earlier, if there is money from the private sector or from the organization that could supplement what the Department of Education has, if that's what it takes, I mean, there could be language that would allow that to happen. That may make it more acceptable to Ways and Means and the department.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, yes. I think the previous testimony was just that this is not a new program. This is just kind of codifying one that's been there a long time. And that's why the bill needs to get to Ways and Means, so that the Ways and Means folks can put another funds limitation in or whatever they need to do to allow them to spend the money that they can generate through the private sector.
Good. Thank you.
Senator, yep.
Well, just now a comment. I mean, it sounds like the fiscal we have before us is not the operative fiscal to be looking at then, from Senator Byer's testimony.
Mr. Chair. I'm not the budget person, but I'm just stating that there is a position in the Department of Education already, and that this is not the intent of the bill, as the previous witness testified to, was not to expand anything, do anything different. It's just to codify it and you know, reshape it a little bit. So if we need to do something to change that, I don't know what we can do because the position is already there.
Just a comment, especially with the faces that are behind you. I think it's just critical that we continue a program that I think has served our state well. And a concern that I would have, I think many, that young people wouldn't continue on in family farms. And it's good to see the folks behind you. So I think it's a great program that we ought to at least ensure that future young people have the opportunity and all the guidance that they would need to continue on.
Mr. Chair, and in response to that very briefly, because other people here who want to speak to the bill, but I think when you were in school, Future Farmers of America was strictly an agricultural group, and when I was in school, it was also defined or kind of pushing people to that. Today's FFA is different, and I think that's important to point out, and hopefully some of them will. My kids have been in FFA and the Moala. My son is here to testify today. He's the current president of the Moala chapter. FFA is grown to be an organization that is not just talking about farming. It's about being a citizen, being a leader in a community. And I think it's important to recognize that I think probably all students could benefit from the skills they teach in FFA, and it's farming is still important and important to them, but it's more than that now. It's kind of become like a future business leaders or something like that, more in that scope.
Well, I would hope it keeps agriculture, I'm sure, that's focus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to meet with you and talk about this to see if there is a way to make it happen. And I will certainly vote to send it to Ways and Means. And, you know, if there is a way to incorporate additional money into it that satisfies them, you know, I think that would be an addition to it. So I will.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I will work toward that.
Appreciate you very much. This chair has been a BOAC teacher, been a BOAC FFA member in high school, was president of the collegiate chapter of Future Farmers of America at the University of Idaho. Hot BOAG, have a son who's hot BOAG in this state, and this program is terribly important, way beyond the recognition it gets, and so I want folks to know that we are. Short of time today, I'm going to allow all who have signed up to come forward and testify, but I really would encourage a brief testimony because we have five other bills and I do want to have hearings on each of them. So we're going to get started at the top of the list. Anna Shepherd, and it looks like somebody printed in Neil Beyer. Is that the son of the senator?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Lacey McReynolds.
Hi, my name is Anna Shepherd. I am from Clackamas, Oregon, and I am currently representing the FFA Association as the state secretary this year. I'm a city girl. My friends are city kids, and I live a mile from the Clackamas Town Center. I'm within walking distance of food, clothing stores, and entertainment. However, I've always known that something was missing. There has to be more in life than the finished product. My inquiring mind needed to know where things come from. As a shy, naive freshman, I went against the norm and joined an ag science class. Little did I know, I was also joining the largest student leadership organization in North America, 460,000 members strong. Here's how my world began to change. My first experience as an FFA member was showing a market lamb at our county fair. At first, I was unsure of myself. It was hard, but I had fun. This led to public speaking. At first, I was unsure of myself again. It was hard, but it changed my life as I was awarded first runner-up in the National Prepared Public Speaking event last fall. This branched my Ag in the Classroom teaching experience. in an elementary school. At the beginning, I was unsure of myself. It was hard, but it allowed me to make a difference in the lives of 50 young students, and it also became my senior project, my CAM endorsement, and also satisfied my career-related learning experiences that are required for me to graduate. This ultimately led to my leadership experiences. In all offices I've held, I felt unsure at the beginning. They've been hard, but I have now an opportunity to impact the lives of 4,500 FFA members across the state as a new state officer. I'll be able to share with them about career opportunities in teaching, veterinary medicine, business, sales, journalism, politics, law, and hundreds more. Now, I am more than a city girl, and I have my agriculture education to thank for that. Thank you.
Afternoon, Chairman Starr, members of the committee. My name is Neil Beyer. I'm the Malala FFA chapter president. And I'd just like to speak briefly on the FFA and what it's done for me. I've been a member of the FFA all 4 years of high school, and it's the impact it's had on my life is just too great to count or to name here. I mean, without this program, I wouldn't have had the courage to come before this committee. It's greatly improved my public speaking skills. I began public speaking as a freshman when my FFA advisor, Mr. Gilmore, came up to me and said, "Would you like to compete in the beginning public speaking contest?" And ever since then, I've enjoyed competing in that contest. I've done it for 4 years now, and I've been fairly successful, not quite to the level that Anna made it, but still. another contest that I've greatly enjoyed is parliamentary procedure, which I practice that all of you go through every day. It's helped me out a lot. It's a fun contest. It's helped me out with my ability to think on my feet and speak. And the benefits to this organization are so great, and it would be wonderful to be able to continue that on for the future generations. I know myself and the 45 other members of the state would greatly appreciate it, and I know Chairman Starr has said that he is a previous FFA member, so he understands the benefits that we go through too. So just greatly appreciate to be able to continue this organization on. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lacey McReynolds. I'm representing the North Clackamas FFA chapter. And I have been a part of the FFA program as well as Anna and Neil, but I have taken FFA to a different level. And one of the things that FFA has given me throughout the opportunities that I've taken is the ability to go to college and spend my time in college with some of the projects that I have started in FFA my senior year. Since this is my senior year, I was required to do a senior project to graduate high school. I just gave the exhibition today, but that project is also part of my agri-science project for that FFA program. Now, it's continuing on to nationals for the national convention, but one of the things I'd like to do with that is I'd like to take it to the college level and perform it on a larger scale so that I can get more accurate data with that. Through these projects and other programs that I've done through our ag classes, I've had the ability to talk to many industry people as well as college professors. And now I sit here before you today and tell you that I have college professors asking me to come to their school. I don't have to search for those colleges. Oregon State University is hopefully going to take me up on that offer and allow me to proceed in their college courses and do my experiment there. But there is no way I could be here today and do those projects without the FFA, because I wasn't able to have that background, and those agricultural careers were just not an option for me in the beginning of my year. I've spent 3 years in that program, and I was an outstanding member of our chapter. So as Star Greenhand, I was able to push myself to the limits. I stretched myself really thin, and I can see that in our other members. However, it's really easy for us to stretch ourselves thin because we have so much support from those ag teachers and other students who are in that program with us. Now, the one thing that I want to tell you today is that FFA has given us a huge advantage as students of typical high school situations. We see kids getting fives and sixes on their benchmarks and their sims and their cams. But to me, it seems like that's too low of a standard. Because what 5 and 6 means to them is that it exceeds, but for 5 and 6s, for us FFA members, means that it's like a 2 or a 3 in our book. And so I'd just like to say that the FFA has given us many, many opportunities to advance well beyond a typical high school situation and to really get out into those industries and get a hold of those people who want us to be a part of them and to be future prospects for their job opportunities. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've got Barry Bashu, John McCulley, John Chandler. Got three chairs up here.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, I think it'd probably be better if all three of us just sat down and let you listen to what these three eloquent children, just young folks, just said. So, but I will continue. I am Barry Bashu. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation and a member of the Sandy FFA alumni. My wife and I raise berries, vegetables, nursery stock, flowers, and pumpkins near Gresham. I'm also proud to be the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 844. The future farmers of America have established an exemplary program which serves as a model for leadership and community involvement. It is a program that enjoys the support not only of the agricultural industry, but the local communities as well. FFA provides unparalleled opportunities through which students can develop skills in leadership, parliamentary procedure, and public speaking, and I think you've just had an excellent example of that. Skills I think we would all agree are valuable. Additionally, there are opportunities for manufacturing, fabrication programs, landscaping, livestock judging, soil sciences, and numerous other related skills and studies. Much of the current budget discussion centers on education. Here is an opportunity to highlight and further legitimize a true success story. I understand the funding crisis you as legislators face, and I won't get into that. Senator Beyer did that very well, and I believe that Senator Morissette has addressed that issue, as will the rest of the committee. But I would urge you to send this to Ways and Means. There are already dedicated and interested people involved as advisors through existing programs. There are organizations such as Farm Bureau and many others with a vested interest in the success of these types of programs. It seems that there is a process in place, and an advisory committee should be able to be established with minimal cost, if any. This is a successful and important program which has functioned well for 75 years. This bill recognizes the value of the program and embeds it in statute as a legitimate educational opportunity for today's youth. Oregon's Department of Education should be embracing opportunities such as these to highlight the benefits of these programs. This is an exceptional opportunity to help our youth excel and become increasingly involved in their communities. I urge you to vote yes on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley, here today as the former member of the Malin FFA chapter in Klamath County, and Mr. Chandler and I also had the wonderful opportunity to be state FFA officers, so we come to you from that perspective. I'm also representing the Oregon Fairs Association, the Agricultural Cooperative Council of Oregon, Northwest Farm Credit Services, and supporting Senate Bill 844. I've also been asked by Dave Nelson to let you know that the Dairy Farmers of Oregon and the Oregon Seed Council also support Senate Bill 844. We think this is a very positive bill that needs to go down to Ways and Means to have all of the issues you've heard about discussed, and we look forward to participating in those discussions. The one comment I would add from some of the folks I represent, you can see why they support the FFA program based on the testimony you heard from those young people. They are the people that the companies I represent are going to employ in the future, and they are excellent, excellent people to have employed in your business.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler here, appearing as a former state FFA officer, 1974, from Culver, Oregon. And just as a citizen and as a parent, I wanted to support Senate Bill 844. Individually, I can testify that there was not a single piece of my academic life, college, law school, otherwise, that had as much impact on me as my involvement with FFA. Speaking, running meetings, the science, the projects like these youngsters have talked about are critical. And as a parent who had four students in the public schools in this state, I think it is a part of their education that was lacking in the Portland district. A vocational, technical education. I don't make my living welding, but I can weld. I don't make my living farming, but I know how to drive a tractor and I know how to buck hay. Those experiences that I got through FFA are missing in too many of our young people's lives today. This program is critical, not just for the farming industry, as these gentlemen have talked about, but for our state and the leadership skills it develops, the ability to be comfortable speaking, the ability to learn how it is to be a productive member of society, which is what the Future Farmers is about. And I don't, for my money, I don't believe there's a single thing that I participated in or my children participated in, drama, music, sports, nothing, that has as much potential impact and benefit as this program. I commend it to you. The issues you've heard about budgetarily can be easily addressed down in Ways and Means, and I would urge you to send it down there post-haste. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Calling testimony, we need to have Katie Cannon and Katie Fass.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, I'm Katie Cannon. I'm the director of the Oregon State Fair, and I'm here in support of this bill. And I want to let you know it's not just because FFA is a real key part of the Oregon State Fair, but I have seen what this program does for kids, not just these kids, but my kids. And I have to say that what it does is it develops very responsible, mature individuals that are good citizens. And I know that there's a fiscal impact statement on this particular bill. It is probably includes some of the money that's already in the current service level. But if you take 4,500 students and you divide that into the fiscal impact statement on this, it's less than a good pair of tennis shoes that it's going to cost you to develop good citizens. So I wholeheartedly support this program and this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Starr, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fass representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The cattlemen are in support of our Senate Bill 844. The FFA program and the related educational courses give students an opportunity to apply their English, science, mathematics, and other courses. And we've seen a fine example of that today with the students' testimony they've given. This is why the FFA program needs to be a critical part of the curriculum in our education system. The cattlemen also strongly endorse the advisory committee that this bill sets up. The advisory committee would bring education sector and then also industry together to look at the programs and make recommendations. This has been happening on the local level, and we believe it would be successful on the state as well. I urge you to send the bill on to Ways and Means to look at the fiscal impact. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All the good testimony.
Now, could I...
Senator,
I guess I'm disappointed that we don't have somebody here from the Department of Education, because I'm interested in the breakdown of the fiscal impact. And I'm interested in this bill, and I will do what I can to help get it through. And if we're dealing with the advisory committee costs, that's where I think we could, what I was talking about previously, could help. The ongoing program, of course, is part of the budget, or, you know, part of the, I think, the present budget. But I'm interested in the breakdown of the fiscal. So I will certainly do what I can to help that.
Appreciate that. I think that is an issue for Ways and Means, and we will bring this back for a work session next week and get it down to Ways and Means. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 844 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 498.
Yeah, because that could solve some problems. Well, that takes care of 90% of the people in the room.
Did we lose Senator Ringo?
He's where I see him. From my angle, I can see him.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. He's got this non-controversial bill involving Stevenson's bill.
Senator Ringo, we have just opened the work public hearing on Senate Bill 498. Would you care to introduce the bill for us?
Thank you very much, Senator Starr, members of the committee. I'm Charlie Ringo, senator from Northwest Portland and portions of Washington County.
Get used to it.
Get used to it. Thank you, Senator Morissette. There's a lot that I can say about this, but frankly, I think the best rationale would come from the members of the Beaverton School Board that came down to testify. I know they're a little bit further down on the list, but I was going to ask for your indulgence, Mr. Chair, whether you might ask them to come up now and present the bill on behalf of... they're over here, Mike Leopold and Ann Jacks.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Please come forward.
And I would also just like to state that I've got, and I'll put out here for the committee, written testimony from Mike Leopold. And attached to this is a letter signed by Joe Rodriguez, who's the superintendent of the Hillsborough School District, on this subject. So I will put this out and ask that you... keep this.
Do you also have some amendments for us?
I do. The amendment that I have essentially would change the nature of this bill to set up a task force, and I would like to go into that after Mike and Ann have had a chance to testify as to why I think a task force is appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I say one thing on the task force?
Sure.
We just, and we don't have to get into it, but we just had a task force.
Got it right here.
Okay. You're on.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mike Leopold. I'm a member of the Beaverton School Board. And I believe it's essential that local school districts have options to help kids. Therefore, I wrote to Charlie and am encouraging you to support Senate Bill 498 and or any amendments that Senator Ringo proposes. This year, over $2 million that the Beaverton School District would have received under the state school fund was distributed to our ESD through administrative costs and other costs, not serving or benefiting over 35,000 kids in the Beaverton School District. As a member of the local school board, I'm entrusted by the community to be financially responsible and fiscally prudent with the taxpayer resources that you distribute to our district. I would be abrogating that trust by not supporting Senate Bill 498, which would increase the flow of resources to the children of the Beaverton School District. Passage of this bill will encourage reflection, discussion, and decisions to be made at the local level. As the legislature struggles to fund schools adequately, this is one small component. Allowing decisions to be made at the local level is part of the overall solution I hope you seek to educate children statewide. ESDs do provide essential services. The legislature, through the SSF, should be funding individual school districts with the resources to adequately serve our kids. If this isn't occurring, then the option should exist for us to serve the kids in our district. I do believe that Senate Bill 498 will help kids by allowing direct access to resources and services and the allocation decisions to be made at local district level. Thank you.
Thank you for allowing us to come up and speak, giving us the privilege of coming to speak with you, particularly when there's other people waiting, I know, too. As the gal before testified, and from the FFA, this is a difficult thing to do. We do utilize the ESD in our district, but
excuse me.
I'm Ann Jacks, and sorry. And as a member of the Beaverton School Board, I represent 35,000 students and over 109,000 voters in Washington County. So I'm here today to ask for support of passage of Senate Bill 498 that Charlie's put forth. As you well know, because you're dealing with it every day, as we are, we're in tough financial times that require sometimes drastic measures. And this is considered a drastic measure by many people. Beaverton School District is the third largest school district in the state of Oregon. And although we do utilize many of the services that the ESD offers, last year we left $1.8 million in unutilized services sitting on the table because we were not able to use them in the way that the small school districts do. We have our staffs to do curriculum adoption in-house. And for a large school district, that's a monumental task to study curriculum and what teachers and administrators feel and parents feels best directs the educational services of our students. So it's different on a large scale like we have than in a smaller district. But we utilized over $4 million, and we're the largest consumer for the Northwest ESD. In addition to the money we receive for our school district from the ESD, we received 10% less than we would have received had we received it directly from the state because of the administrative charges they scoop right off the top, and that's over $400,000. That's a lot of teachers. That's a lot of services. And I understand that small districts do benefit from this, and we do benefit from it too. But again, it seems to be an issue in our district of the Northwest ESD district of large versus small. Our board took a tough stance and voted against the ESD budget because we felt for our students we couldn't leave that $1.8 million sitting on the table, yet we weren't able to take it in cash credits. There's a cap of 50% that's negotiated between the superintendents of what the cap will be. Well, it came out to be 50%, so we left that money sitting there, much to the thrill of some of the smaller school districts because they utilized it. Again, we're supporting the small school districts, large versus small. We can't afford to do that. In 2000, the legislature completed the interim task force that Charlie talked about. And as a result of this study, the legislature passed two major pieces of legislation, Senate Bill 259 and Senate Bill 260. 259 reestablished the primary missions of ESD to provide equitable, high-quality, cost-effective, and locally responsible education services at a regional level. And it also contains specific references to the 21st Century Schools Act, which I understand, you know, there's some House bills that are looking at changing some of the SIM requirements. Senate Bill 260 addressed the issue of funding in regards to equalization with the portion of the state school fund being distributed to the ESD. And that's another issue with the ESD is the funding, inequitable funding of ESDs throughout the state. If my students were housed in Multnomah ESD and our district was housed there, instead of the over $4 million, we would have received $10 million this year. That's a huge $6 million that they get. And there's an equity issue there again. I have a comparison study that our superintendent, Jim Carnes, did by contacting Multnomah, Clackamas, and Willamette ESDs. And they all function differently with regards to the menu of services offered, the percentage retained for operations, and the amount allowed to be used by the school districts in cash. And I have a copy of that attachment for all of you, along with a menu of items that our superintendent submitted to the superintendent of the Northwest ESD to give us more choices, to try and work things out, to try and make it a little more equitable. And with our school district, as many of you may know, we stand to lose next year $30 to $35 million. And we're working on that right now. And although this is a really hard thing to even suggest, I feel, as Mike does, it's my fiduciary responsibility as a school board member to make sure that we're using every single dollar for the benefit of our school district. As you know, we have a local funding option before the voters. So again, I'm down here wanting to show them. I'm in support of giving every dollar that I can for our kids. and our school district. I don't know what else to do. So in view of the fact that we left the $1.8 million on the table. There's a 10% administrative charge that's scooped right off the top. I'm suggesting that we support Senate Bill 498 and that you seriously look at this and look at how our ESDs work. And I understand the money it takes to do a study, believe me. Mm-hmm. And I know it was done.
Yes.
Thank you.
And my only thought is I do not think we should study. As a matter of fact, I think the idea of studying this is just we should either do something. And
right.
Your testimony was actually pretty compelling that I think, and it doesn't need to go to Ways and Means, so it shouldn't have a subsequent referral. We should send this right to the floor, and Mr. Herborg is not going to like to hear this, but in some ways that is the case, and I think it's a pretty compelling testimony. And the voters of an area choose to opt out, then I think seeing it Ways and Means is a bad idea. I think studying is a bad idea. I think we know the issue.
That's really the opportunity we'd like is if we decided to do that, if the large districts. We are way larger than any of the other districts. I mean, any of the other districts that Northwest EHSD supports. And if we chose to opt out, I mean, we could do that. And we understand there may be some consequences. You know, maybe our service costs will be more expensive. Yes,
you
sorry.
Can give us a written test.
Yes, I do have it. I do have it here.
Oh, okay. Well, it saves us from taking notes. If you know
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may just kind of add where I'm coming from on this. When I look at the organization of our schools and I ask, what is the purpose of an ESD? I think the answer is an ESD is to provide services that a school district really can't provide for itself. And usually that's based on economies of scale, because particularly in smaller areas or rural areas, a school district just doesn't have the capacity to handle some of the special ed programs, informational technology, media programs. There's lots of programs that a smaller district just can't provide for itself. And that's where I think an ESD is absolutely critical. But then you have to ask, so why should you have an ESD in a very large district like Portland, like Beaverton, like Hillsboro, that does have the capacity to provide those services for themselves? And I think the answer is you really don't. You probably don't need Beaverton and Hillsboro probably don't need to be in an ESD. Now, if you look at the letter that Joe Rodriguez submitted, you'll see he gives some statistics. It says that of the ESD dollars, and this is the Northwest ESD, 10% goes to their operations. So in essence, that's overhead.
Mm-hmm.
Then you see that 22.5 cents goes to support core services. Okay, 22.5 cents core services. The next paragraph says that both Beaverton and Hillsboro take full advantage of the service credits and they purchase significant special ed materials, but both districts use very little, if any, of the core services. This means that there's 22% of the ESD dollars that Beaverton and Hillsboro really don't use. In addition to that 22%, you've got the 10% overhead. So that's 33% of dollars that are of no value. And I shouldn't say the overhead's of no value, but it doesn't go directly into the classroom. So what does that get us? And if you're on the Beaverton or Hillsboro school board, and if you were to say, would you rather have the ESDs exist as they do, or would you rather have those dollars flow directly to the school district, and the district can use those dollars as the way they see fit, I think the latter is what they would definitely prefer. Now, the argument that you're going to get is that, well, because you've got the Northwest ESD, that's helping to pay for some of those services that some of the smaller areas couldn't provide for themselves. And I am very, very sympathetic to that argument, because this should not be presented in terms of urban versus rural or the bigger school districts versus the smaller districts. But it does seem to me that if ESDs are to provide services that a small district can't provide for itself, then it makes sense to redraw the boundaries of the ESD. That's where I think we should eventually go on this. Now, Senator Deckert, I completely appreciate your suggestion that maybe we don't need another task force, that we should just pass this out. And we did have just a task force. October 25th, 2002. But let me just read to you the legislative charge from that task force that was set up by the last legislative session. There were four things. Actually, I don't want to read it. I guess I'll just say none of these directly address the issue of what is the role of an ESD? What's an ESD for? Where should they exist? Where may it be appropriate for them not to exist? And that's what my amendments relating to the task force would essentially tackle. And I can read you these four things. The things like create a catalog of services offered by ESDs and school districts. Well, that's all in here, but it still doesn't address my essential point. Should Beaverton, Hillsborough, Portland, the larger districts, even be in an ESD at all? And that's the question I'd like addressed.
Further questions?
Just Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a point. I don't think we should study this. I think we know the answers to those questions, and I think the idea that we spend in Cinerengo, I just think we ought to vote up or down and have a good discussion of it and take some action.
You really don't have an argument for me. I guess I was trying to take the more modest approach by hoping that the harsh light of the task force, sometimes it's harsh light, sometimes it's not, might lead to the same result. But I appreciate your attention during this testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We do have several people signed up, four individuals. If you'll all come forward, John Mott, Mike Curley, Randy Shield, and Mike Thunderbird. Only three seats in front there. One of you can take a rear seat and then move up as...
Well, when the music stops, everybody sit down and we'll see who's left there.
Yes, please. Okay.
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I appreciate the opportunity to sit here and explain to you my opposition to this bill. I have a unique background in education.
Before you begin your testimony, we need your name on the record.
Okay. My name is John Matt. I'm currently superintendent of schools in Scappoose, Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay. I have served in the past as a school board member in a school district approximately the size of Jewell. I've graduated from high school with approximately 3,300 students. I've served as an educator in school districts of a variety of sizes. I've been an employee in a school district approximately seven times the size of Portland Public. So my background is with large and small schools. And I would present to you today that the definition of inequity is equal treatment of very unequal entities. And that's what this bill would perpetuate, is inequity. Because as a small school district, the services that I can provide to my students are nowhere near what the larger school districts in our region can provide. If you took my high school curriculum and laid it down next to Beaverton's, the opportunities for the students there are vast. The ESDs provide us with some movement towards that equity. And I believe that it is the charge of the ESD, and I think you heard that from one of the Beaverton board members, that equity is the reason for the building to exist. So on that note, I would say that for Beaverton to opt out of that or to receive the money directly, as this bill calls for, would be happening on the backs of our students in Scappoose and all of the smaller school districts in the Northwest region. So thank you for the opportunity to present today.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Any comments or questions?
Chairman Starr and committee, I'm Randy Shield, superintendent from Tillamook School District. Born and raised in Tillamook and now serving as superintendent, I've seen the ESD from various perspectives. And over the course of the years, the ESDs have changed. For example, Tillamook used to have their own. We've now been consolidated into the Northwest Regional ESD, which is housed in Hillsborough. It's a little different perspective from there. As a mid-sized school district in the Northwest region, the ESD is critical to us. We face serious cuts. like everybody else has, and like Beaverton is speaking of now. Cuts such as 1/4 of our elementary schools closed last year. That's one out of four. We have cut 47 out of our 300 employees last year. We are in a tough situation just like everybody else is. To change the structure of ESDs the way this bill would do, or the possibility of it, would only increase the disaster that's happening in Tillamook. In the statement from Beaverton, it said they're here to support their students. And I guess I'm here to support our students. We truly need the help of the ESDs in order to provide an equity of service that I believe ESDs were set up for. And the kids in Tillamook need that. We've lost a lot of things over the years, and it's becoming more and more difficult for us, as it is for Beaverton and Hillsborough. In this case, though, it's set up with a good structure that helps kids across 20 different school districts at different levels.
Could I ask you,
Senator Bill?
Yeah, thank you. The testimony was that Beaverton left $1.4 million on the table or whatever. Now, does that mean that that money was then redistributed among the other schools or what?
Are you asking me that or them?
Well, I figured someone of. How do you respond to that comment that they made then?
Well,
he'll be up later.
Okay.
I guess I would like to know how that 1.4 was left on the table. That's a different perspective than what we might have.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Starr and Education Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you for just a moment. I come to you with a little bit of a dual perspective. My name is Mike Corley. I serve as the superintendent of Clascon High School District 6J, but I also own a ranch in eastern Oregon, in rural southern Baker County. Hopefully my grandchildren will have the opportunity to use ESDs in Baker County. My perspective is this. It comes from very small, very rural, very maybe a different environment, but you know there's a reason we build roads in eastern Oregon instead of just Beaverton, and that's because we need equal access for people of that area as well as we do from people to Beaverton to Portland or Hillsborough to Portland or someplace else. So if we take a look at access, my position on this is pretty avid. We need access. We need, the access that we're provided to the SD is an equalization access, which is unlike the equity formula that we have in education today. There's nothing equity or nothing equal about equity formula. As Mr. Matt talked about a minute ago, I would like to have you look at the class offerings at Clascon High School and hold them up alongside the class offerings of Beaverton Hillsborough. There's no equity. This is one of those ways we can reach equity. That small portion of the state budget that goes into the ESD funding does distribute out some services that aren't equitable for smaller districts. I might also, if I may, use an analogy for just a moment. Some of you, it made me feel good today because my father was an FFA member. I was an FFA member, and I taught vocational agriculture for a while, and both my children were FFA members. So let me use an analogy from there. You're an Eastern Oregon rancher, and you run on common. You raise your cattle with a group of other ranchers. You have a 100-head permit. Somebody else has 500-head permit. If somebody else does only puts 440 cows or 50 cows on that permit, it's not your fault. The resource is there. It's available for them to use. I asked Beaverton to take a look and try and provide opportunities for all children of the region. Don't pull your cows out and blame us for your problems. Take a look at the resource and use that resource to your potential and provide opportunities for all our children. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you very much. And I should say in advance, and I probably should have said with the prior panel, I think the reason that we're here, we have several bills that have brought us to this point, and I think to not acknowledge and put front and center on the table is funding of education in the state, and the pathetic level of funding that has come from this building, which puts us in this position, that we have more and more bills with people arguing over the resources that are left. And so I think that has to lead, that the funding in the 90s, and then we're seeing it again in about a week, where that 30 to 35 million is about to be grow because this legislature is unable to produce adequate funding. Now, having said that, I'd like to put a question to the panel, maybe to the last speaker, because the way we have used equity is through our income tax dollars, and that is the way you ought to do it. And I can tell you, contrary to your testimony, that it has affected the Beaverton Public Schools. I think it's affected the Portland Public Schools. And I think their CALs, I think they fail to the tune of $400 million a year through the income tax and through equity. $400 million a year, rightfully so, leaves the metropolitan area just through the school funding formula. So I think they would say, I would say, we've put those CALs out there. And I guess the question is, why should we do it also through the ESDs? And further, why should we not allow those economies of scale within the rural, smaller communities? And I came to this hearing really open on this question, but I'm solidifying my position that we really should allow those rural, smaller counties and districts to use the economies of scale themselves. But I don't think we should. The income tax is the way you do that redistribution, and it's rightfully so. It's what you should do. I don't think the ESDs are an added on. We should do it once, not twice, three times. And we really should have an equity formula that ensures Scappoose and other in Tillamook children are receiving that basic level of education.
Thank you, Senator Deckard.
I have a question. There was a question.
Oh, there was a question in that?
Is why not use the small counties together rather than using the ESDs as a further...
We've got a gentleman in the back row here.
Yes,
wants to answer that.
If I could address that, there isn't the economy of scale within Columbia County. Can I not be heard?
We don't really have the economy of scale within Columbia County or the amount of money that would be required to do what we need to do. And also in response to Senator Morissette's question, we would love the luxury of being able to leave $1.4 million on the table anywhere. We spent every penny that we got from the ESD and utilized all of the services. There were areas of the ESD that the ESD provided at a more economical level that I didn't have to hire, which allowed me to move towards more equity with the larger school districts. So in response to that, we don't have that luxury. We don't have the amount of scale or economy in Columbia County to do what we can do as a four-county region.
I think we also have, we each have our own issues. You speak about what the metropolitan area sends out, yet Tillamook, I think, owns the Tillamook Burn, and yet back before our timber revenue went to the state, we had money. We don't have that anymore either. We all have different issues, whether it's Klatskanai or Tillamook or Scappoose. So.
Thank you. Time's running here. Let's move on.
Thank you, Chairman Starr and members of the committee. My name is Mike Thunderberg. I'm the superintendent of Arnonia School District, small rural school district, served by Northwest Regional ESD. Previous to this July, I was a superintendent in Central Oregon, a small rural school district served by Crook Deschutes ESD and Jefferson County ESD. I mention that because I have perspectives on more than one ESD as a superintendent. I've also been a high school principal for a high school principal of a high school bigger than the district I serve over K-12 right now. And that district 10 years ago in that high school, I had better services, more curriculum and programs such as the FFA program you just heard about than I have right now in my school district. I think the issue here is dual fold. Right now, the fiscal situation K-12 in Oregon is a tragedy, as we all know. You know, these all of superintendents and all school boards right now are dealing with the financial impacts of the lack of revenue we have right now. We're trying to build budgets for next year when we haven't even completed this year's budget. Many of us are still trying to figure out how to get through this year by cutting programs, cutting days. We've cut 6 days in my school district. We've dropped transportation for athletics for the rest of this school year, things that affect kids everywhere. The ESD comes in as a service. I think the key, and maybe coming back to Senator Deckard's question, is that once again, It's called a service district, not an ADM district, not a dollar-for-dollar district. It's to provide services for those schools that can't provide those services as a small school district. And it's not a Beaverton-Vernonia, Beaverton-Tillamook issue. It is a big school, small school issue statewide. If you take the money away from the small schools to try to balance this budget, and take the top 10 school districts, there's still almost 190 other school districts that will not be able to function and provide the services that they are right now. In my situation, July 1, I took over another school district. I look at our state test scores. We need some help in math. I don't have that ability in my school district to provide that learning specialist, that improvement specialist. I can't go out and hire that person. I don't have the financial resources to do that. The ESD provided that person for me to come in to work with my staff. You gave me two or three times as much money as ESD receives right now. Based on ADM, I still would not be able to afford that. I have a speech pathologist that comes in 2 days a week. I could not go and hire that person. First of all, you couldn't find the person willing to work for 2 days a week with those skills. They wouldn't come to work for Vernonia if I could afford to do that. You'd have to pay them full salary. I don't need them. If I had to do that, and the law requires me to do that, I would have to cut additional programs, additional services to students. The ESDs are critical to the schools in the state of Oregon in terms of equitable service, not equitable dollars. We're all hurting for dollars. Columbia County, going back to your question, is just over 35,000 people in the whole county. You know, I think I heard there was over 100,000 voters in the Beaverton school district, in the Beaverton area. You know, we can't compete. That's why a lot of shop at Costco. You know, it's the issue of buying in bulk. The ESD allows us to buy services in bulk that we could not afford individually. That's a powerful argument that no matter what you do in increasing money or doing an ADM, we will never be able to afford in that bulk as an individual small district to receive those services. It's tragic that we've gotten in the situation where the small school districts on issues like this feel like the big district is playing the big gorilla, beating up on the little guy. We can't do that to each other in the state. You know, it is too late, even if this was a good idea, for us trying to build budgets for now and next year to even look at this issue. I don't believe it deserves to go to the floor. I think it's too late to even address the issue with our financial situation right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Todd Herbert. Herbert, please.
Senator Marcet had a question for you.
Senator Starr, committee. My name is Todd Herberg, superintendent for the Northwest Regional ESD. Be happy to respond to that question, but also after hearing the testimony from some of the other folks, would really like an opportunity to correct what I consider to be some fairly tremendous inaccuracies.
Please.
Okay. What I'd like to start with is that relative to the ESD budget, I heard a term in reference to administration costs, 10% administration costs or markup. That's in reference to the ESD budget division between operations and direct services. Operations is 10% of our state school fund, and direct services are the other 90%. In that 10%, we pay for all the supervision, HR services, technology, facilities, insurance, business services, legal costs, and any other indirect type of function for the other 90%. That's what that 10% represents. Within the 90%, it was shared with you that our model in Northwest Regional ESD is that approximately 25% of our resources go into what we call core programs and about 75% go into what we call service credits. Service credits are issued directly on an ADMW basis. We had a little confusion in the earlier testimony because I heard numbers used interchangeably from this past year, this current year, and next year's resolution plan. What I would like to focus on, because we have the complete historical data from last year, and we have almost a complete year of data from this year. Next year's resolution plan, it's difficult to talk about the specific usage because those programs have yet to take place. But if we could focus, for example, on current year, it would be inaccurate to characterize Beaverton leaving $1.8 million on the table. I don't know where that number comes from. We got about $18 million for the region, of which if you use their logic of a pro rata, that's about a third for the Beaverton School District. Again, I shared with you the 10% description of our operations, with about 20 to 22% this year going for core programs. The balance was issued in service credits. But I think that it would be important that you have the specific numbers and percentages that reflect the actual service credit allocation for Beaverton this past year, so that you're not under some misnomer that there was $1.8 million on the table. The other piece that I want to speak to specifically within core services, and this has been well documented, and again, we can provide it in hard copy for you, but within our core services, our largest single expenditure area is special education. Our largest single area of special education cost within core is the staffing we provide in the Beaverton School District. If that special education staffing wasn't provided through the ESD's core programs, the Beaverton School District would need to provide those special education staff. So to say that all the money from core was left on the table, the first specific hard evidence example I give you is that our largest expenditure area in core is special education. Our second largest is technology services. And again, can provide hard evidence of the specific technology services received this past year by Beaverton, which include extensive programming services to adapt their system to address emerging HR and special education reporting needs. To a lesser extent, they utilize our instruction and school improvement, which is our smallest area of core service. But we have lots of data about their teachers' participation in our in-service programs and their building requests and utilization of our school improvement services. So I would offer that we can provide ample evidence that the Beaverton School District utilizes each of our three core service areas. So to characterize it as money that was wasted and not brought to service to the Beaverton School District, I would take exception to that. The issue of the process that we use is one where we do work with all 20 superintendents. We work to identify the individual district priorities as well as the regional priorities, and it is a give and take between large districts and small districts. Our small districts would prefer that 100% of our resources are in services, core programs. Our largest districts would prefer that it's 100% service credits, and we have found a compromised point in between that puts 25% in core and 75% in service credits. I want to go back to a specific technology example because, Ryan, you asked the question about couldn't you do this in the smaller rural counties. Mm-hmm. We operate and are the backbone of the technology system for the four-county area. It basically costs us the same to provide that central infrastructure and accessing service and internet filtering, etc., for all 20 school districts as it would 17 or 18 or 15 or 12. So if we were to pull Beaverton out of the mix or Beaverton and Hillsborough out of the mix, our cost of providing that service would remain relatively constant. The economy of scale that we have with 20 school districts in four counties provides a level of technology access that would not be affordable and available absent our region-wide cooperative. Now, does Beaverton realize the exact per student proration benefit of the technology system? I'd be the first to say no. But there's benefit there. The number's not zero. It's not 35%, but it's not zero. And again, I think that if we're going to be using those kinds of numbers and percentages, we need to make sure that we're dealing with actual hard data and evidence before we rush to any conclusions. And I'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
Can I ask? Could Beaverton save money by fully utilizing the services you provide?
I believe so, yes. For example, in school improvement, again, we provide curriculum services, curriculum adoption services, that is available to use. If a district chooses to staff that individually and not take advantage of that, that's their decision, but it's there to be used. In fact, a couple of our, what I would consider to be mid-sized school districts, have already informed us that through budget cuts they've had to eliminate their individual curriculum positions and will be relying on us wholly for that function next year.
Senator Duckett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Todd, thank you. And I have to just say again, I think funding has to be front and center on the table. It just strikes me that we have, in this education committee, issues like this with vending machines up. The other day, and just we get a continuous issue like this. Having said that, you have a lot of experience in Roseburg and Northwest, and stepping kind of out of the Northwest region, do you think there is a there in not short term, but midterm, of taking your more districts? I mean, I can see how the Columbia County example does not work, where you would just do, you have no economy of scale there, but a larger, more smaller rural folks districts, not just a few, but a lot of them, and using that as your ESD boundaries rather than the current configuration we have today. And I would just have your kind of your experience throughout Oregon and ask you, do you think that is worthy of not short-term action, but at least midterm exploration and progress?
Okay. Oh boy, I'd have to give that some thought. Senator Decker, before responding to that, in part I could respond in that I think there is a benefit of the regional services that is lost when you exceed, for example, 90 minutes driving time.
Okay.
In order to get on-site service, because a 90-minute one-way, 90-minute return for a specialized service is reasonable and doable. If you get much beyond that, it becomes pretty difficult to provide those services from a central location.
So you would say,
but that would be an example of where I think, there's such a thing as getting too big to where you lose the effectiveness.
Senator Marsha.
Well, thank you. And I don't know if you're familiar with the councils of governments. I was mayor of Springfield for 10 years, and I served on the Lane Council of Governments, which provides services to cities that can't afford to hire people to do things that the council of governments do. And I always equate that with the ESD. And when times get tough, districts rely more and more on these centralized agencies that provide the services that they can no longer afford to provide. And so I think that at least councils of governments make more sense when times are tough than they are when times are good, when people can afford to do that. And I would assume that's the same true with school districts. That same is true with the school districts. So I just... You know, I value very highly the services performed by the ESD. Now, how they're performed in different places, I think, is something that we need to talk about, but it just is something that is essential, I think.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 498 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 827. We have three people signed up. Let's bring you all up together. Steve Dixon, Rocky Dalton.
Mr. Chair.
We don't have you signed up.
I know, I just walked in.
Why don't you start in for us here?
Okay.
Introduce the bill, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Vicki Walker, and I'm State Senator for District 7, and I introduce this bill on behalf of the Oregon Student Association. The bill does a couple of things. It requires the higher education institutions to provide a debt and credit card education program as part of the orientation ceremonies when students come on campus. It requires the State Board of Higher Ed to adopt by rule the minimum content requirements of that education program, and it says that they shall use materials and services supplied by nonprofit organizations when providing such a program. And the third section says they shall not not sell the name, address, or telephone number of an individual who's been enrolled or is currently enrolled at the institution. This issue came up in a couple of ways. My very own daughter got sucked in by one of these credit card companies. They are all over the campuses. They bring toys. They bring gifts. Sarah got caught by students who she felt sorry for them. They use a line of pity on them. I'm trying to earn money for a scholarship. Would you please sign up? You won't have to activate the credit card and you get all these free gifts. Sarah ignored them, but her roommate got into the program and made her feel bad, so the next day on campus she got into it. 6 months, she got a card in the mail that said, to activate this credit card, please call this number. 6 months, and she didn't do it. 6 months later, we get a statement in the mail from this credit card company saying, welcome to our company, yada, yada, yada. So I quickly, being the good overbearing mother that I am, we drafted a letter to the credit card company, told them to disengage her from their account and that we did not appreciate that they activated her. This happens all the time. We're going to have people from Augsburg and the Student Association tell you about the techniques that these marketers use. Unfortunately, so many of our schools don't provide financial planning anymore. All of the high schools have dropped these programs, and we've got to get the education somewhere. And Mr. Chair, as you well know, in our Judiciary Committee, we've been hearing the issue of credit scoring, Senate Bill 260 and 280, and just this morning we talked about that. When these students sign up for these credit cards, they often get way over their heads in debt, because if you've ever been a student in college, you know that you eat ramen or macaroni and cheese to survive. You get a credit card and voila, you have a little bit of extra cash to spend. And without proper education, some students just go overboard. We also have had in my Business and Labor Committee today a bill, Senate Bill 159, on payday lenders. Payday lenders and title lenders. They have become a huge, huge market in this state and across the country because people can't manage their debt. Now, you might say, why is it the role of state government to manage people's debts? Well, I think it is the role of an institution of higher learning to give education to students about this debt, particularly when they allow them on their campuses. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to draft in the bill a prohibition against these credit card companies from offering free gifts, because it would violate Oregon's free speech provisions in our Constitution. We have a quite liberal free speech provision. I was meeting briefly outside with Lisa Zavala for the higher education folks, and she was telling me that they cannot currently sell the names and addresses of students. But I would ask you, that's a distinction without a difference, because she'll tell you that they make that information available at cost. So, you know, at cost and selling, you've just got to be careful about how you ask that question. But she's indicated to me that under the federal regulations, they have to provide that information. And that what the system does is require students, ask students when they sign up each term, they make available to them to be opted out of the directory so that their name's not made available. I think that's another tool in the toolbox for the students so they don't get caught into this system of debt. I would show you the Credit Union Association has put together this booklet called Financial Literacy in Schools, and I'm a member of a credit union and a bank. And they have suggested ways for developing financial education legislation. And while they believe that financial literacy should begin in kindergarten, the most effective place to educate students is in middle or high school. But we just simply don't do that anymore. We've just whacked the heck out of our school budgets. I think someone needs to be educating our students on good financial management. I don't see that it's a difficulty for our institutions of higher learning to provide that in the orientation session. And these pieces of information can easily be made available by the Credit Union Association, and they are a non-profit organization, so they would qualify under the bill. So that's why I'm here today. That's why I wanted to bring that issue to your attention. I would be willing to pull Section 3 from the bill if that is an issue we can't avoid because of federal law. And I'll let the folks behind me talk next. It's your pleasure. Do you have any questions?
Any questions? Thank you, Senator Walker.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it.
Members of the committee.
Now, we are running out of time, folks. Come on up, and if you got written testimony, let's have it. Give us a summary of what you have to present as briefly as possible.
Okay, great. Good afternoon. My name is Steve Dixon. I'm the consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG, nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest research advocacy organization. And college, I just found out about this hearing today, so that's not actually written testimony. It's something I downloaded for you to take away with you. You can look at it's a report that we put out on educating people about how to avoid credit card hazards, and it gets at a lot of the issues I'm going to talk about. College students face credit card offers that charge interest rates as high as 30% per year, and you can see all this stuff at truthaboutcredit.org, which is our website. And students are host to a bunch of unfair and deceptive terms and conditions, saddled with enormous fees and encouraged by credit card companies to make low minimum payments, which would, of course, incur more interest for the credit card companies and lead to students paying more on the money that they borrowed from credit card companies. As a result, the average debt for Americans who carried a balance reached an all-time high in 2000 of $5,610, and that was an increase of one-third since 1995. Under regular credit criteria, many students would not qualify for credit because they have no credit history or little or no income. But the market for young people is very valuable. Industry research shows that young consumers remain loyal to the first cards that they get as they get older, so the competition is very fierce to get students. Nellie Mae, the largest student loan agency, found that 78% of college students had credit cards in 2000, and the aggressive marketing combined with the students' lack of financial experience and education led many students into serious debt. Some of the following undergraduates with credit cards carried an average balance of $2,748 on their credit cards in the year 2000. Half of all the college students with credit cards don't pay their balances in full every month. And, of course, the more you pay on a credit card, the less you'll end up paying in interest overall over the life of the loan. Nationwide, 58% of college students reported seeing on-campus credit card marketing tables for two or more days within 1 month period of the beginning of the term, a time when students are facing significant pressure to finance their education and, you know, a place to live and books and stuff like that. On a test of personal finance skills administered to high school seniors, students averaged a score of 57%, an F on any grading scale. Only 5% of the high school seniors scored a C or better. And college students with a credit card loan of $2,000 and an interest rate of 19%, who pays back the loan at $40 a month, would incur interest charges of $1,994. And they are oftentimes, in the material that is put out by credit card companies, encouraged to make it's put in such a way, and you can see this information on our website, it's put in such a way that encourages students to pay only the minimum, and they would end up paying more. According to a 1998 study of college students and credit cards by the Education Resource Institute, the potential accumulation of high interest payments on large amounts of credit cards occur when students are offered, four more cards are owned. Again, Rocky will speak about the tabling tactics, but a typical thing is they try to get students to thaw as many applications as possible. The average credit card balances are greater than $1,000. Balances are carried over each month, again, not paying the balance off in full. And tuitions and fees are charged on credit cards. And, of course, the repercussions of high debt load for college students include overwhelming financial stress, withdrawal from college, damaged credit history, the emerging question of using credit information for other things, such as getting a homeowner and auto insurance, and in the worst cases, bankruptcy. And students need to know about all the pitfalls that they face when they're going out and dealing with significant financial pressures. And I would encourage you to look at ways to educate students on this issue.
Thank you.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, Rocky Dahlem, Legislative Director, Oregon Student Association, and I'll try and be really brief here. We support Senate Bill 827 and think it's important in opening the discussions regarding credit companies on campus and an accountability to the problems that are caused by student debt, some of the things that Mr. Dixon mentioned, and the access that credit companies have and the effects that will have to students on campus. As he had mentioned, tabling, gifting, different sort of methods that the credit companies use in order to get students to sign up for credit cards, these processes, tiered gifts, additional gifts for signing up for more cards, different marketing tactics and things like that, which students aren't always aware of, especially in the beginning weeks of the college experience. I think that usually at orientation, most campuses will have four or five or more credit companies on campus giving out Frisbees and T-shirts and water bottles and things like this. So we think that this is an important time, an important discussion to have regarding the access that the credit companies do have to student information and students in the campus and where students and that market for the credit companies is, and looking for methods to help students and find some protection for students. So we appreciate your consideration in hearing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. First, we recognize that this might be a serious and potential problem, and we certainly support the intent and the objectives of this bill. We believe that in two cases, both sections of the bill, first, Section 2, placing the responsibility for educating and advising students on the use of credit cards and the accumulation of debt is perhaps misplaced in this bill. Oregon University System cannot authorize, and we cannot prevent a student from obtaining a credit card at any time or any location. The university system also does not have the responsibility, nor should it, in the management of the assumption of the debt by the student. The average age of our student on campus, Mr. Chair, is 25.6 years old. We believe that it's expectation of the student to be guided by his or her own ability to assume and manage the debt at that stage in their life. If the assistance in debt management is required, the student has a number of other resources outside of the university environment to obtain that assistance, whether it's through the guidance of their parents or private resources such as consumer credit counseling services. To require the institutions to develop a debt and credit card education program is a mandate without funding, and which in reality should not be the responsibility of the institution. Again, we do want to recognize that this could be a problem, and we are very much concerned about the debt load of our students. Because now, Mr. Chair,
To what extent do you facilitate credit card companies?
I'm sorry, credit card.
To what extent do you facilitate a credit card company coming on campus and using your facilities to do their thing? I mean, do you have any restrictions at all, or do you get a cut out of them coming on campus?
Mr. Chair, Sarah Moore said, of course, no, we do not get a cut, but they do have access to the campus, and it's public property, and the credit card companies can come to the campus and solicit applications from the students.
Okay. Do you put any restrictions on the methods that they use, or is it possible to do so?
Mr. Chair, Sarah Moore said, I am not certain what restrictions we place, if any, and I would be certain and certainly will be following up on that and getting back to you and to Senator Walker on those restrictions. Be happy to do that.
Could I address that? My understanding, and I'm not sure exactly what the restrictions are, that the Portland State University has some sort of restrictions in place on credit card marketers on campus. I couldn't accurately tell you what they are, but that is my understanding.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Depp.
Thank you. That, if you could add me to the list, Lisa, I think that's the solution to this, is that knowing that there is a problem, that that universities in particular develop some sort of guidelines to protect students, especially incoming ones. And so I would love to be on your list of kind of where we're headed with that.
Certainly. Absolutely. Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd like to address the provisions in Section 3, as Senator Walker had indicated. We were speaking out in the hall about this. The universities are regulated by the Federal Education Records and Privacy Act, FERPA, if you will. It's kind of an odd animal because, while on one hand, FERPA, under FERPA, institutions are required to provide student directories which contain names, addresses, telephone numbers, email addresses of the students to anyone upon request. However, the students are notified in our campus catalogs and in our course schedules that they have the right under FERPA to have their names unlisted or delisted from those directories at any time, just simply by asking, requesting that to be done. FERPA also allows the universities to recover reasonable costs of the production and, guest distribution of the student directories. So we could charge somebody who asked for a student directory, we could charge them for the directory, but we are not making a profit on the directory, so we would say that we are not, in fact, selling those names. I will indicate, however, just for sake of disclosure, campus alumni associations, which are 501c3 organizations, separate and independent of the university system and the state board, do make practice of selling membership lists. They do that to affinity groups, credit card companies is for one, travel entertainment insurance industries for, and they make the profit through royalties on those sales. However, as I said, alumni associations are representative of alumni, past students, and they are independent of the system.
Thank you very much. No additional testimony, or no one else signed up to testify. I want to thank you for your testimony. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 827 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 338. And we had some people here that are not in the room, but apparently they're just outside. Let's see. Did we have a... We don't have either the senators who are sponsors.
I said go ahead and call them up.
Okay. Let's have Lori Wimmer and John Marshall. Tuck Bennett, I don't see. He's his time allotment for the day.
I suppose.
Please.
Mr. Chair, committee member for the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. I am sorry to have to report that the Oregon Education Association is testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 338, as we have for two prior sessions. We have positioned against this bill, though we've participated in work groups to try to improve it in a way that would be sufficient to our concerns. We have a long list of pedagogic, technical, financial, and constitutional problems with the bill. We believe that it is a misnomer to call it, for example, the expanded options program because of the money squeeze to high schools. In fact, it is a contraction of options for many more students than it would seek to help. In these times of huge financial desperation, we believe that the money squeeze issue makes this bill unviable because it imposes an unfunded mandate upon all school districts in the state, irrespective of their ability to provide these funds, which would follow the student to either a private or public college education at taxpayers'
expense. We believe that contradicts efforts elsewhere in this building to unload unfunded mandates on school districts, for one thing. The money essentially is rerouted, the public funds, to these higher education institutions, public or private, in order with no gatekeepers or any other kind of mechanisms to evaluate whether students are psychologically ready, whether they are academically of a sufficient proficiency to be college students. It doesn't account for the financial situation of the sending school, as I've mentioned, nor does it means test the students who would receive up to full two years of free college at taxpayer expense. We already offer statewide in Oregon's 198 school districts, or many of them, various similar programs for about between 22 to 24,000 students in Oregon who participate in the 2+2 programs, school to work, professional technical education, and other kinds of high school college partnerships that are done on a voluntary basis where there is the will and the means to do so. We support, for example, another bill that is coming over from the House side that would expand the professional technical opportunities for high school students who are looking at that aspect of this kind of program that was sponsored by the Associated Oregon Industries and the Speaker Minnis. And we testified in support of that bill as a compromised version instead of this one. The bill has a long list of other problems, such as how to handle the special education considerations when school districts have the last dollar responsibility and yet these kids may be going elsewhere, transportation cost issues and safety issues, the imposition of students on community college students. We represent community college faculty and classified as well, and those campuses are already overcrowded and woefully underfunded, and yet these students would be imposed upon them. There are a number of other concerns that we have regarding the bill, but I'll stop now. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
The counterpoint to the last thing, statement you made, I believe that many of our community colleges are now delivering studies online, electronic classes. Is there a problem? That doesn't have anything to do with crowding, or when you have the programs available through an electronic delivery system. Well, it would seem to me that there are opportunities, and certainly right on the horizon where we're going to be looking at how not only community colleges but high schools are delivering programs like that.
Mr. Chair, I think distance education is a separate and distinct issue from this bill, perhaps not, but my understanding is that this contemplated students actually attending the campuses of other schools.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and I will not repeat some of the issues that Lori's raised, but we certainly join her in opposing Senate Bill 338. And I think the primary reason is the fact that in Oregon today, somewhere around 24,000 high school students are already earning high school or college credits while they're still in high school, either through higher partnerships with higher education institutions, both public and private, community colleges, and through some distance learning opportunities where they're overseen by a teacher in a high school classroom and they're actually engaged in taking these college classes through over the internet and either through an Oregon institution or even in some cases out-of-state institutions. So the concept of allowing high school students to get a head start on college is currently in place, and we believe that the best decisions are those that are made the closest to the people affected by those decisions. And local school districts have worked together with their higher education and community college partners to create these options, and will continue to do so. So we believe the bill is unnecessary for the reasons that Lori has stated, and would join in opposition to it.
Lori mentioned, and I think somewhat in contrast with what you just mentioned, that the decision best made by those directly involved you mentioned gatekeeper. I think that, personally, that I believe the student and the parent really should be the primary decision makers as we look at what might be made available for them or how they might complete their education. I don't really have any questions. I do appreciate your testimony, and we're going to be visiting with sponsors of the bill, and I hope you will have a chance to talk to them. We may or may not bring this back, but as you can see, we have a committee of one here.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, I just want to respond to your question. I would agree that that students and their parents ought to be free to make decisions. But I think there may be necessary to provide some guidance to the student as well as their parents to make sure that those decisions are made with an academic interest in mind. And I think one of the concerns we had with the original concept of this so-called Student Bill of Rights is that oftentimes the student may choose to walk away from their high school, take the dollars with them for a variety of reasons, many of which aren't really focused on what's in the best academic interest of the student. So I think it's a partnership between what the parents and the student believe is in their interest, as well as with the professional educators to assist that student make good decisions relative to their academic future.
I agree.
Mr. Chair, one other thing. Another legislator in this building shared with me his own personal story about how he and his parents set up a program similar to this, kind of a unique arrangement, wherein he went to Portland State University as a 16-year-old, and he said it was the worst mistake of his life. He felt that he was both academically and emotionally prepared for this, but he really felt that he wasn't, and he basically told me that he crashed and burned. And part of his reason for opposing this bill when it was up before the legislature 2 years ago was because of his personal understanding of that experience. He also said that as a father, he would have a great deal of reluctance sending especially his daughters, he told me, to away to college for classes without any kind of attendance requirements, because colleges don't take attendance, so there aren't some accountability mechanisms the way there are in most high schools. So those were some of his concerns, and I thought that they were valid, and it was from someone who had already experienced a program like this and had a different perspective.
I appreciate that a lot. You might visit with my youngest, who sits in the Oregon Senate. He came to me after beginning the first few weeks of his senior year and said, "Dad, you know what I'd like to do? That I'd like to just follow that man, candidate for the United States Senate, around for the next 8 months and learn all that I can." Well, he was just beginning his senior year, 16 years old. He would turn 17 in January. After talking to his counselor and the principal of the high school and finally the superintendent, we got permission for him to finish his schooling while following that man around 60 or 70 hours a week. And it was the right choice for Bruce.
And did that candidate win?
Did that candidate win? No, he did not. But he did follow him around.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you for your testimony. We have a couple of others signed up to testify. Reem Nevins and Grant and Karen, please.
Mr. Chair, Rem Nivens with the Oregon Community College Association, and I'll be brief. We do have some concerns about Senate Bill 338, and basically for us it comes down to a funding issue. As testified before, our campuses are very much in demand in terms of the amount of students that are coming to our colleges now, particularly due to the economy. And we just feel that looking at the program that's going to bring more students in is going to be difficult for us from a fiscal standpoint. We're already having a hard time serving all the students that require our services now. For us, it would be extremely difficult to take on any more students that might be coming through our doors. we do agree in this, with the bill in the sense that in the ideas of the bill that, you know, we would like to offer many opportunities for students who, you know, find a better educational opportunity at a better venue. And we do have contracts set up individually with a lot of our colleges that work with high schools and to bring high school students into the community college experience if that's what fits them best. And we continue to do that as much as we can. But like I said, our overall concern is a fiscal one and the fact that we're just not in a position to take on any more students in a time when we have a lot of demand as it is and not the adequate amount of funding to service them. So that's all I have if you have any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Gretton Cairns, Director of Government Relations to the Oregon University System. Also try to be very brief. The university system, as it did 2 years ago and as it did 4 years ago, supported the concept of the early options, Running Start, or the other kinds of programs like this that there are in the United States of America, primarily because the State Board and the campuses of the university system really believe in a learner-paced process of education, and we remain student-centered as the central focus for the decision-making process. We believe that there are many students who are on our campuses now who are enjoying a benefit of this opportunity on their own motion and from their own dollars and are succeeding. We have many partnerships with high schools across the state, and a law like this, which has been proven to be very successful in many, many, many other states in the United States of America, would extend that opportunity to all students. The bill would have to meet our own standards, and that is that we would not accept a student until we had determined that student was academically prepared and qualified to take on that coursework, that it was part of a overall scheme on that student's part for their own academic career. And we believe that putting faith in students and their ability to meet and overcome challenges is something that we all ought to, as educators and those involved in the education process, keep uppermost in our minds. Having said that, however, we're not of the opinion that this is a time for this bill, as printed and as designed, to go forward in the fiscal context that we find ourselves in. We are not in a position to suggest that the kind of budget impact that would be felt by this would be something that we could recommend to any of our education partners at this time, but we would not relinquish our interest in having a process in which every student in every high school had a equal, and by that I mean equal, effective opportunity as opposed to a theoretical opportunity to seek advanced coursework, get an early option, get a running start, and be able to have that opportunity, and ought to remain as one of the objectives that all education sectors, K-12, community colleges, public universities, to seek ways to facilitate the learner and keep the student at the center of our thinking.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all the testimony. And with that, anyone else? It's been a long day. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 338 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 791. Jan, would you tell us what Senate Bill 791 is about here?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 791 directs the governor to establish a task force in the office of the governor to study and report to the governor on how to obtain multiple source funding for a program to enhance workforce training at community colleges.
Wow. Yeah. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Bill 791 and adjourn our Senate Education Committee for the day. Thank you very much.